This is Wage World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3,
the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come visit me?
This is Wade Rathke, and you're listening to Wade's World, a Voice of the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Greenville, Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay. Points north and south, east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at www.kbf.org or www.acornradio.org. A podcast will be available to the show on those websites and affiliatedmediamovement.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world, and today we're talking to Ricky Gard Diamond, who's a contributing editor of Vermont Woman, but also the author of Screwnomics, How Our Economy Works Against Women and Real Ways to Make Lasting Change. Welcome to Wade's World, Ms. Diamond.
Well, I'm honored to be with you.
Oh, well, lovely. Screwnomics, that's a title now. There's something that gets your attention. We better start right off and tell people, what do you mean by Screwnomics?
Well, I can tell you that my mother would not have approved of this word, but it's better than...
It makes the point, Ricky.
it does. Screwnomics is the unspoken but widely applied economic theory that women should always work for less or better for free. And that theory applies to our Mother Earth, and also to those men who do what is traditionally women's work. They take care of their children or cook dinner or work as teachers or nurses and are discounted as well. So the real question is, why is that? How did we get to that place where we discount what is so important?
Well, through that, and in looking through the book, one of the things I noticed is your personal story. You sort of came to an I should share this. Before I started Acorn many millions of years ago, I organized welfare recipients for the National Welfare Rights Organization. And I think you ended up with a close and personal experience with the welfare system, which is part of what seems to have opened your eyes about Screwnomics.
How did that work? I never expected to find myself at the welfare office. I was working full-time. I was divorced and had three children, but I also had $25 in child support, and yet I couldn't make my budget work, no matter how hard I tried. And I just felt there was something wrong with me, and I was ashamed. I went to the welfare office and surprised again, because there I was in my business suit and earrings and much better dressed than the other darker faces I saw in the office. And they had children like I did. And the white social workers came out and gave me an appointment right away. And I felt embarrassed about that as well. So it was a really unsettling experience for me. Later I learned, at the time, I didn't think monetary policy mattered to me. I was part of the economy, but frankly, it intimidated me when the economics was talked about. And later I learned, after I had moved to Vermont and got involved in the war on poverty, and where the poor in Vermont were as white as me, and the only people of color I met were university professors. So it was a different demographic. But, whites continue to be the majority of the poor, but it is still, if you're African-American or Hispanic, you've got twice the chance of being poor that white people have. And just as women are much more likely to be poor than our men. So there are these systemic things at play in what happens.
Well, in reading your book, you don't make any bones about the fact this seems to be deliberate.
Well, it seems to be very reliable the way that we sort ourselves out. And what I've noticed is the bigger the piles of money in any realm, the more exclusively male it is. You know, money speaks, as Andrea Dworkin once said, but it speaks in a male voice. And that also is a curious phenomenon. When I did a series of articles for Vermont Woman that later won a national newspaper award for investigative reporting, they cited my unusual sources, by which I think they meant women, because I had found a number of female sources, you know. And
what year was that?
That's fairly unusual. That was 2012.
That shouldn't have been such a news story that women would have been in the conversation in 2012, but that sort of makes the point of what you've probably seen over decades in terms of the treatment of women in economics, or what you call Echo Man. What's Echo Man?
Econo Man.
Okay.
Econo Man, yeah. It has a social construction, I think, because I think we're operating on a half-conscious level. I actually had some interviewers, and, you know, most of the interviewers that I talk to about the economy, they're usually men because we, you know, it's just the way things are. And some of the one of this lovely gentlemen said to me, you know, I'd never really thought about how men dominate the money world. And, you know, I guess men just haven't had a reason to think about it so much, I think.
Well, it certainly, you have to be deliberately blind. I mean, there's reports almost every other day in Wall Street Journal and even the New York Times about how few women are CEOs. In fact, there was a thing I'm sure you noticed a couple of weeks ago that there are more CEOs named John than there are women CEOs of the top 500 companies.
Oh, wow. Well, you know, the Economan is not just a man, but he is a man of a particular class, a particular race, a particular mindset and education, who he expects to profit, he expects to rule, and he expects to make the rules. And those are, you know, I think that is that unconscious sort of thing going on that we need to be talking about more openly.
Well, I don't want to argue with you, but I mean, now that we look at the White House, it's hard to see any of that as unconscious. But
it's true. Economan has taken his mask off these days. Yeah,
no,
we don't usually see it displayed so openly.
No, it's all right out there for everybody these days. But women have a very, I mean, it's not so long ago that we can remember it was difficult for women to buy property in some states. Some of these reforms are
grand juries.
Exactly.
Vote.
Exactly. Well, now we're going back. But what you point out as well is that for women, this wage difference that you were mentioning when we talked about welfare, there's been progress, but it's not really enough, is it?
No, it's not. It's up at around 80 cents in some places when you average it out. When you look at it by race, it's, again, just, you know, women, white women like me had to work until, I believe it was April 10th this year, to make what a man earned the year before. For Hispanic and African American women, that, you know, they'd be working way well into summer to catch up. So that still is happening, and yet I think that that ratio number, which only shows the relationship between men's median income and women's median income, really show how what so many Americans are feeling, which is, you know, tighter than ever, because while women have made these advances, most often they've made them because of advances in their education. And for that, they've often, you know, borrowed money to go to school and then earn less money to pay that money off. at the same time, men have, at least working white working class men, have really lost ground, and because of what's happening with the global economy and also with robotics and the elimination of jobs, a trend that we can see is going to continue. Meanwhile, you know, prices keep going up and outrunning wage increases. Today, there were reports of the unemployment rate being lower than, you know, any time since 2000 or something. And yet, you would think with the shortage of workers that there would be an increase in wages, but there's no evidence of that yet. And so wages have generally been stagnated since the 70s, and the median household income is usually not one paycheck, but two paychecks, or maybe even three. So it's tough going out there.
It is. We're talking to Ricky Gard Diamond, who's written a book called Screwnomics, about how our economy works against women and real ways to make lasting change. Ricky, the point you made about jobs, now women are concentrated in service and caring jobs, clearly,
mm-hmm.
even education.
Mm-hmm.
We see something fairly remarkable recently in these teacher strikes. I mean, Arizona was reported in the paper, teachers on a 3-year deal after being on strike for several days, have won a 20% increase. Before that, we had Oklahoma and West Virginia. What do you make of that? Is that teaching is still a largely women's dominated profession? Is this real progress,
oh, yes.
sign of change?
I believe it is, and I'm very excited about it, because I think what we've got going is an economic Me Too movement. I think that women are beginning to support one another in this taboo territory of money, and uniting and asking the question, why should this field be discounted? Why is caring so caring and attention and what could be more important than the education of our children? So I think it's very encouraging, and I expect that to build momentum. You know, women are getting together, and they're beginning to talk about realms they haven't entered before. And it's one thing when you have a token woman who has to play the game that exists, you know, that has to, I think of, you know, Annie Get Your Gun, that old Broadway play where she says, anything you can do, I can do better, you know, and so she can be, she might have to be as meaner than the guys just to get ahead. But when you have a critical mass of women, as you have with teachers and with nurses, and now with growing unions of domestic workers, and also fast food restaurant workers are organizing in ways that are, it's really hopeful to see it. And they're broadening the discussion beyond just money is earned. It's not just about wages. It's about respect. It's about purpose and meaning of the work that you do.
Absolutely. I mean, although it is disturbing, I mean, one of the fastest growing jobs, and it's almost totally dominated by women, is still home health care, home daycare, the last number of decades. Yet we still see, you know, draconian policies around not paying overtime.
We surely do. Yes.
Why? I mean, yes, as you just made the point, the education of our children is extremely important. It's hard to beat it. But so is care for the elderly, care for the infirm.
Yes.
And yet people are lucky to make minimum wage, much less $15 an hour. I mean, do we see anything rising there in the same way that we see teachers rising?
Well, I believe so, because robotics cannot replace that caring and attention from those jobs. And so there are groups that are really looking at more closely measuring that what I'm thinking of Rianne Eisler and her Center for Partnership Studies that has developed a new additional measure to the GDP, which is the number everybody trots out to measure the economy. That's only about money. But she and a woman economist, Nancy Fulbright, have developed what they call social wealth economic indicators. And they're arguing, and I think they'll do it effectively because intuitively we know that it's true that if our families and our communities are connected and caring and paying attention where they need to, that it's better for the economy overall. You're going to see results in the economic realm. And so they're actively measuring those kinds of indicators, and many other countries are. United States is so behind so many countries, including our nearest neighbor, Canada, nearest northern neighbor anyway. You know, they're way ahead of us in understanding how important parental leave is for mothers and for fathers, how important family leave is because families have illnesses and everyone is helpless at one time or another in their life, at the beginning of your life or at the end of your life, and often, you know, between two. So
we all need all the help we can get, Ricky.
That's right. That's right. And so we've had this old division between this comes out of the 19th century, the idea that the commercial sphere was a man's world. It was dirty and it was dog eat dog and mean. And you wanted to protect women from that. This was the ideal. It was never true for so many women. But she was to be the angel of the house and make sure, you know, everyone was rested and happy and well-fed and going to church. And so that was her realm. But the two realms are not at all separate. And in the American imagination, I think we continue to think of those as two separate things that have to be, you know, we think of the home as sacred, and it may be that, but
why don't we value and put a value and a price on child care and household work,
yeah,
women? Because that
exactly
must be a fundamental part of Scroonomics, huh?
It is indeed, and there are there's close attention to what some states are already doing, what some legislators are already proposing. There are clearly economic ways to do these things because other countries have been successfully doing it and continue to do it. And Americans just need to be open to thinking about it. Right now, those things are so not on the table anywhere in the American political discussion.
But one has to believe that the fact that family leave is unpaid leave, for example,
mm-hmm,
makes it a
mm-hmm
little bit of a vacuous reform because it essentially, in neon signs,
yeah,
you know, flashes, oh, okay, that really has no economic value. Yet a
That's
lot
right
of people, I mean, talk about a class divide and class, race, everything else. People who could afford to take family leave are limited to those people who have more income. This has to be a Scroonomics on steroids, huh?
It's true. It is true. And those are, you know, I also talk about the cost of care that, you know, when women left the agricultural world to become the angel of the house in the 19th century, her production of manufactured goods in the home, like her canned goods and her weaving and her, you know, her other wealth production, including her production of labor that would then, you know, work on the farm, her children, they became her retirement package, you know. All of that was changed when she moved into town, and in industrialization took that manufacturing jobs, took all of those manufacturing jobs, and, you know, we got canned goods, and we factory-produced textiles, and she became what economists named a consumer. And what had been her wealth production became her expense, her cost. And now it costs, the USDA does a study of what it costs to raise a child, and this doesn't even count college costs. It's now up to $700,000 plus just to raise a child. Now, that's not something angels like to even think about, you know, but it's the reality that families are facing. And so if all of society is benefiting from the production of American citizens and our young people, then that cost, I think, needs to be better shared, and could be. There are lots of vehicles for helping that to happen. We just have to believe that it's important and agree to address the real pressures that young families are facing.
Well, in all families. Meanwhile, you know, work requirements are exploding past welfare to, you know, demands in Congress to, you know, prove that you can work to get Medicaid, to get housing benefits. We're talking to Igard Diamond, who's written a very interesting book called Screwnomics, How Our Economy Works Against Women and Real Ways to Make Lasting Change. So, Ricky, let's talk about some of the ways to make change. You talk towards the end of the book about the cupcake economy and how to share the icing, which is a great metaphor. Give us some ways we can get the icing shared around.
Well, that cupcake came from Hazel Henderson, who created the cake illustration that's in Screwnomics that shows that the economic activities that we count with the GDP is really the icing on a big cake that requires, you know, governmental support, and that has this little that is resting on the bigger layers of the what she calls the love economy and on Mother Nature. And so I propose that because we have so many regions in the country and in the world, we really need to think more locally and have smaller cupcakes that you know recognize that larger phenomenon that Hazel was talking about. And then I also talk about the importance of ethical investing, which she also talked about, and that can also be local investing. Right now, Wall Street is the sole enterprise going on in the country, but it wasn't always that way. You know, it used to be that there were local stock markets, and there were local currencies is another innovative idea that a lot of people, especially larger cities, are undertaking. And this is important because right now our currency is only produced through the Federal Reserve, which could also use a little re-examining. And it is created through the vehicle of debt by our private banks. Another important change that I think is happening is people are beginning to pay attention to the Bank of North Dakota, which is our nation's only public bank, meaning that not that it's a state bank, there are lots of state banks by title anyway, but this bank is capitalized by the people of North Dakota and their tax dollars.
Thanks to the Nonpartisan Farmers League back in the early parts of the 20th century. Hazel Henderson was a great supporter of ours decades ago. It's good to hear her name. You also think we ought to look differently at taxes and use fees, don't you?
Well, I do. You know, taxes is a sore subject, but we've been hearing this message that government is the problem and that taxes are a bad thing. It really depends on what you get for your taxes. You know, other nations pay high taxes, but they get, you know, wonderful returns on those tax dollars. They get affordable child care that pays a good wage. They get affordable health care or even free health care. And we pay high taxes and we don't get those things. What we do have is an enormous military expense and an ongoing war. In fact, you know, we wage the economy as war now, and we really need to figure out how can we wage life. We can, but we need to think that that's more important than waging war.
Absolutely. But, you know, with these things like the controversies around grazing fees out west that we saw prominently in recent court cases and in takeovers of public lands, I mean, you argue, I think, in Scroonomics that we also ought to make sure that people are paying to use federal lands and paying fair use for public access like communications and other things, you?
Yes, yes. I think that is critically important. And again, it's this idea that whatever is a public needs to become private. And most of us, that kind of a setup works best for the 1% and the 0.1% who own most of the assets and would like to control more of it, apparently. I don't know when enough is enough, but most of us
seems to be never so far. Yeah,
yeah, but most of us really are our greatest assets are the collective ones that we share, and so it would behoove us to protect those assets and to think about our collective lives, because you know. This idea of the economy being made up of rational individuals is I think a false one and laughable, really, because nobody becomes an individual all by himself. You know, there are always families and society and cultural constructions like Economan that help shape how we think about things. And and so, you know, paying closer attention to those, the things that we have in common. We really have much more in common than we have differences. But I think the wealthiest class has learned that it's useful to divide us. But, you know, our founding fathers said, you know, united we stand, divided we fall. And it sure feels that way right now, that we're on the edge.
Are you seeing women, as you talk to people about your book, Ms. Diamond, are you seeing more women starting to take economics more seriously and stepping up in this sort of what you're calling a Me Too moment in economics and business?
Yes, I really am seeing women very excited about this book because it's readable. I've translated a lot of really important economic thinkers, made it a little more accessible, provided vocabulary and even cartoons at the end of each chapter to help you make this economic thinking, which has posed as, you know, a science way above our heads and having nothing to do with emotions, or to make it very, very personal, because the economy does affect each of us very personally. So women are really excited about this book and beginning to organize into what we're calling econo-girlfriend conversations, because typically women have not talked to each other. They don't say, well, have you noticed what's happening to stock today, or, you know, the unemployment rate, or and talk about money. It just hasn't been part of our conversation. So now we're entering that realm, and we're finding what we have in common. This and I think that the men who love women are also really interested in this book and interested in seeing more equity in our economy.
And since we're talking about the book, where would people find this book, Scroonomics?
Well, we have a webpage, www.screwnomics.org, and a Facebook page, and any bookstore will be able to get Screwnomics from She Writes Press, it's everywhere.
Okay, thank you so much. Ricky Gard Diamond, Screwnomics, How Our Economy Works Against Women and Real Ways to Make Lasting Change. This has been Wade's World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. As the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week when we'll have another guest, this is Wade Rathke from Wade's World. Thank you.